On the program today, the economics of the laboratories of democracy, states and their looming fiscal challenges. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 8th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a nod to the calendar, the fiscal calendar to be specific, because we are, in 45 states of this union, a week into fiscal year 2021, a fiscal year in which those states and all of their residents are going to have to deal with reduced revenues, shaky budgets, and a whole lot of uncertainty. Marketplace's Eric Barris checks in on how some of those states are doing.
What a difference 6 months make. Urban Institute fellow Kim Rubin says when the calendar year started, states were feeling optimistic.
Predicting more money coming in than they were forecasting and more money possibly than the year before. And then March happened and the bottom dropped out.
People stayed home and spent less. There went sales tax. Millions of people lost their jobs. There went a whole bunch of income tax. Meanwhile, Rubin says states had to spend more on swelling Medicaid rolls and soaring unemployment claims, all while beefing up their health response, kind of like a typical recession. But
that is just much more dramatic right now because of the suddenness in how we close the economy and the fact that this is all being driven by this public health issue.
States got some help from the federal government and some dipped into their rainy day funds. They also got some help from the expanded unemployment benefits and relief checks. Catherine White with the National Association of State Budget Officers says those
have helped temporarily prop up the economy and therefore state tax revenues, but that those are going to run out.
The Tax Policy Center estimates that states ended last fiscal year with $75 billion in shortfalls and face an additional $125 billion in this one. And there's a lot of uncertainty playing into that number, says UC San Diego economics professor Jeffrey Clemens. Businesses may open or stay closed, and COVID cases keep rising. State budget officials don't have a full picture of what they're working with. Going forward, Clemens says states can either raise taxes
or they can find ways to, you know, to scrimp and save, to cut expenditures.
Some states are already doing that. Washington is furloughing workers, and Ohio is planning cuts to K-12 education. And then there's borrowing. Adam Levin is with the state fiscal health team at the Pew Charitable Trusts.
Given the magnitude of the problems that they're facing, they're going to, again, have to consider all the options that are on the table.
He says the Federal Reserve has set up a new borrowing program for states. But so far, only Illinois has tapped it. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Big companies are big companies. They've got lots of operating units, divisions of different kinds and sizes, lots of competing management interests to reconcile. And that gets us to the corporate story of this Wednesday. Even as coronavirus is surging in Florida, Disney World is set to open up in Orlando. It is not, to be clear, going to be the Disney World of the before times. No parades, no indoor shows, no hugging Mickey and Minnie. But as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, Disney does have some cause to be pushing its parks right now.
Disney's brightest spot this year was supposed to be its live-action remake of Mulan.
Loyal, brave, and true. It is my duty to protect my family.
But with movie theaters closed, a little musical called Hamilton stole the show after the company moved up its release on its streaming platform, Disney Plus. And I am not throwing away my shot. But Disney can't only take a shot on streaming right now. Remember, Disney Plus is pretty new. A subscription is just $6.99 a month, and the company doesn't expect the platform to become profitable for a few years. So it needs to look elsewhere. Stephanie Liu is with Forrester.
So Disney has multiple businesses, and most of them are hurting right now.
There's the movie theater thing. Plus, there aren't many live sports playing on ESPN. Disney cruises are suspended, but parks?
They have some more control over the experience and what reopening means.
The company also has experience managing a reopening during COVID-19. Its resort in Shanghai started welcoming visitors again in early May. And Michael Smith, a professor of information technology at Carnegie Mellon, says the parks are about much more than thrilling rides.
Parks is a big piece in the puzzle, but I think it's also a key part of the overall Disney experience.
The parks are Disney's interactive PR tool, and they're key to sustaining the brand. Once people visit the Magic Kingdom, they may be more likely to subscribe to Disney Plus or buy a stuffed toy at the Disney store or someday see The Lion King on Broadway. And if not, the money the company makes off the parks is not too shabby. The price of standard admission these days, $109 a day. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Here is my favorite theme park anecdote of the day, non-Disney to be clear. Saw it in the Wall Street Journal this morning. The Fuji Q Highland Amusement Park in Japan is asking people not to scream on its roller coasters, right? Pandemic, screaming, coronavirus, got it. Please scream, the park's message is, inside your heart, which I love. 2020, come on. Not a whole lot of screaming on Wall Street today. Cheers mostly among traders, also buying that despite the warning from United Airlines of as many as 36,000 layoffs this fall. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Brooks Brothers filed for the legal protections of Chapter 11 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code this morning. Lockdowns and working from home obviously have not been great for the menswear industry. But coronavirus isn't the only thing Brooks Brothers has been dealing with of late. Its go-to offering, the business suit, has been going out of style for years now. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on the rise and the fall of the men's uniform of the business world.
Brooks Brothers opened its first store in Lower Manhattan in 1818, when the U.S. was made up of 20 states. Future customer Abraham Lincoln was only 9 years old. When the suit as we know it today started becoming popular in the late 19th century, Brooks Brothers cashed in.
They were right there at the heart of finance, at the heart of politics, really when America was getting its start.
Susan Scafidi is the founder of the Fashion Law Institute at Fordham Law School. She says Brooks Brothers really popularized suits that were ready to wear off the rack. That helped its suits fit more people, but Scafidi says it also made the suit and the high status it represented more accessible.
Everybody had to have a Brooks Brothers suit if you were going to be a middle class or upper middle class or even an upper class business person.
Scafidi says by the middle of the 20th century, the suit also became a symbol of corporate conformity. Think Mad Men. But in the 1990s, casual Fridays had become a thing. Then Silicon Valley okayed hoodies and sneakers, and casual became mainstream. Justin Shack, a managing director at Rosenblatt Securities on Wall Street, remembers the suit and tie days.
I used to own Brooks Brothers suits back when I was starting my career, and I can't remember the last time I did.
Since 2014, the market for men's suits has shrunk by 11%, according to the research firm Euromonitor. And menswear has changed with the times. Ken Gidden co-owns Rothmans, a menswear store based in New York. He says his biggest seller these days is denim.
So we sell a lot of jeans and we sell a lot of sport coats with it.
Gidden says the suit isn't dead, but the suits he sells tend to be fashionable suits meant for special events.
It's not really classic work wear. That's not what the young guy is looking for in a suit.
The COVID-19 pandemic has only made things worse for the suit industry as people work from home and stores have closed. As Brooks Brothers files for bankruptcy, it says it's seeking a buyer for the brand. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Trying to get a new job often comes with challenges. Trying to get a new job in a pandemic comes with a whole lot more challenges. Steep unemployment, the hazards of in-person interviews, if you can even get them, and questions about what work should even look like right now. But one stumbling block has largely been removed, those questions about how much you made at your last job. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino is on that one.
2 years after Emily Martin graduated from law school, she began clerking for a federal judge. She started at the same time as another clerk who was just 1 year out of law school.
But because he had worked for a high-paying law firm while I had worked for a low-paying public interest organization, he made significantly more money than me for the exact same job and less experience.
She now works for the National Women's Law Center, advocating for laws that prevent employers from asking about previous pay. 19 states and more than 20 local governments have passed such bans, and new research shows evidence they're working.
It kind of blew us away. It's a big difference.
James Besson with Boston University School of Law compared the wage gains of workers changing jobs in Massachusetts, which bans salary history questions, with workers in neighboring states that don't. He found all workers benefited to a degree, but women and black workers benefited most. Women earned 8% more and black workers 13% more than similar workers in neighboring states.
What it says is that a lot of that persistent wage gap, it's related to something about the bargaining process. I may not be at all discriminatory. You know, my company may not be at all discriminatory, but I'm perpetuating discrimination.
As many companies move to address equity in the workplace with splashy initiatives and grand pronouncements, something as small as eliminating the salary history question can make a big difference, says Katie Donovan, an equal pay negotiation consultant who helped draft the salary history ban in Massachusetts.
It's not a sexy program, but it has huge impact.
Still, less than half of states have salary history bans, and two, Michigan and Wisconsin, have blocked local governments from enacting them at all. Applicants can always decline to answer, but that can have negative consequences too, says Wendy Pollack with the Shriver Center on Poverty Law.
It doesn't eliminate the bias that's inherent in these negotiations.
She says when women and black men refuse to provide their salary history or try to negotiate for higher pay, it's often viewed unfavorably, and they're offered even lower salaries. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I can't seem like I need help. I have to look like I have it all figured out. I'm strong.
Saving your business in the middle of a pandemic. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 177 points today, about 0.6%, 26,067. The NASDAQ up 148 points, that is 1.4%. Finished at 10,492. That's a new record. You can't see me, but I'm doing that shruggy thing. The S&P 500 picked up 24.7%, 31.69. AMC, the world's largest operator of movie theaters, is closing in on a deal to avoid bankruptcy. AMC shares up 7.25%. On that note, by the way, the number one movie at the box office this past weekend, where box office is defined as the booth at the drive-in, which are coming back, the horror flick Relic, which took in just under $200,000. That's according to IMDb. That is less than 1% of the box office revenues of the top film a year ago, which was, come on, anyone? Spider-Man, Far From Home. United, by the way, after basically announcing all those layoffs, flat. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is a hard truth and a sad fact of housing in this economy that while some cities can't build fast enough to fit their growing populations, collectively there are millions of vacant and abandoned houses in other cities around the country. A lot of them are in rural areas as well, those vacancies, and Rust Belt cities that people have been leaving for years. Cities like Baltimore, which, despite millions of dollars in investment, has barely made a dent in the vacancy problem. And this pandemic obviously could make things worse. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the first in a series of stories about what's become an intractable and a deadly problem.
There was a time when you could often find Thomas Lemon sitting in his beloved car on North Payson Street in West Baltimore, where century-old brick row houses line the block. The car was a cream-colored 1989 Cadillac, almost a block long itself, with a red top and matching interior.
He used to love to sit in his Cadillac and listen to his radio in his car.
That's his old neighbor, Joseph Snowden. He says one spring afternoon 4 years ago, Lemon was parked alongside a vacant row house listening to oldies.
It was real windy, and the wall just collapsed right down on the car.
Two stories of brick buckled and rained down on the Cadillac, smashing the windshield and flattening the roof. Snowden heard the boom from half a block away and ran to help.
By the time I got over there, it was It's a whole bunch of kids, and they had cleaned all the bricks off the top of it. I took my back, and I tried to lift up on the top of the car to push it up to get the man out of there, but we couldn't get him out.
Lemon died in a hospital that evening. He was 69. On display at his funeral was a red and white wreath in the shape of his cherished Cadillac. The tragedy was shocking, but not surprising. Neighbors had complained about the abandoned house, which the city had condemned 9 years before.
And it's emblematic of Baltimore on so many levels.
Carol Ott is a longtime fair housing advocate in the city.
Because the man who was killed was Black. The house was located in a majority Black neighborhood that has suffered from disinvestment and redlining and predatory real estate practices.
Practices that over the decades have hollowed out large swaths of Baltimore, leaving blocks of 10 and 20 row houses where all but a few are vacant. Ott says the building that killed Thomas Lemon had been bought in a city tax sale by investors who'd let it sit empty for nearly a decade. Alan Malik is a senior fellow at the Center for Community Progress. He spent his career researching economic development and urban revitalization. He says vacancies, and there are more than 6 million across the country, feed a vicious cycle of decline.
Vacant properties don't cause poverty. They don't cause crime and all the other ills of urban neighborhoods, but they make all of that worse.
They become dumping grounds for trash, havens for drug dealers. Dead bodies have even been found inside.
They are incredibly destructive to people's sort of sense of hope, quality of life, aspirations, home value, all of these kinds of things.
After Thomas Lemon's death, the city rushed to tear down hundreds of other derelict buildings near collapse. But the overall number, more than 16,000 vacant buildings, has barely budged for a decade. Michael Braverman is Baltimore's housing commissioner. Since he took charge in 2017, the city's torn down more than 2,000 vacants. Grants and tax incentives have helped homeowners and developers rehab thousands more. But Braverman says,
at the same time that we are renovating vacant buildings in one area, we are seeing additional vacant buildings in another.
Because overall, more people are leaving Baltimore than coming. A city built for nearly a million people at its peak in 1950 is now below 600,000. And tearing down an individual row house is expensive and complicated because people may be living next door. Braverman says it would cost a few billion dollars to rid Baltimore of its vacancy problem. And now there's the pandemic. Demolitions have been on hold since April. And
cities like Baltimore are having extraordinary revenue challenges as a result of the COVID crisis. And so, you know, the amount of money available to do this kind of work is going to diminish.
Endangering even the slow progress that has been made in places like West Baltimore's Harlem Park, a historic Black neighborhood where one of every three houses is vacant.
Hey, you take a bottle, you make sure you do your census now.
Matthew King started the Harlem Park Community Development Corporation a few years ago to help revitalize the neighborhood. On a recent afternoon, he was there handing out boxes of food and supplies to residents.
So we're actually giving out free KN95 masks. We're giving out fresh produce, and they get a squirt of hand sanitizer too.
Black communities like King's have been disproportionately hurt by the economic and human costs of the pandemic. But he says with the national spotlight on racism and police brutality, more people are starting to see.
You know, Black lives do matter. Black communities do matter. And there has to be some significant investment into, you know, urban cities and Black communities to change things.
Blocks away, where Thomas Lemon was killed 4 years ago, his former neighbor, Joseph Snowden, says he has seen some progress. A few years ago, he reported a hazardous building to the city.
The wall was leaning out, and I was scared that the wall was going to collapse and fall down on a child going down to the playground. You know, they came that evening and tore it down.
Now his house sits next to an empty lot, with soda cans and water bottles littering the knee-high grass.
It's better to be torn down than to be vacant, because, you know, you have people that goes in and they burglarize it. Sometimes they go in there and set fires.
Snowden remembers when every house on his block was occupied. Now he's just one of three homeowners left. But after more than 60 years, he insists he's not going anywhere.
Because I was born and raised right here, you know. And I feel like this, wherever you go, there's trouble going to be there too.
So what's he doing with a for sale sign in his window? He says it's just for fun. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We've got a map of West Baltimore's vacant buildings and the pictures that Amy took while she was out reporting that story. You can check it all out at marketplace.org. A couple of months ago, back in the age of round one of PPP loans, we heard from Uli Nasibova. She's the owner of Gelateria Uli. It's two locations here in Los Angeles, should you have a craving. And she was talking about how she was going to be able to hang on.
It just feels like it's too soon that I have to mourn the loss of my business. And hopefully I don't have to. But there's a pretty big possibility that, you know, in a couple of months, I might not be able to keep it up.
Here we are then, a couple of months on. We called her up to check back. Turns out she got a PPP loan in the second round and an economic injury disaster loan as well.
Because of those two loans, I'm in a much better place mentally today than I was when I first talked to you. It's day and night. I actually have the recording on my phone. And I listened to it and I just remember my voice was so like low and I was holding back tears. And I at the time I went through the whole 5-step process of grief, except at the time I thought it was from my business, but it wasn't from my business. It was for the old way of doing business. You know, the landscape is still shifting. Now it's about driving more traffic to the website, about premeditated orders as opposed to impulse buys. Before, you know, being a woman, being an immigrant, you're always comparing yourself to other business owners or to what you think they are. And you say, okay, I can't seem like I need help. I have to look like I have it all figured out. I'm strong. One thing that I started doing, especially at my lowest, I started calling people, asking for help and saying, how do I do this? How do I implement this pivot? And a lot of what I'm doing today, none of it is my invention. It's mostly just me taking advice from people that said, hey, have you thought about a subscription model? Have you thought about e-commerce? Have you thought about curbside pickup? We launched our subscription box model on June 24th. I'm going to the customer and saying, hey, you used to have to think about it. Now I will bring this to you. Moreover, I will do it every month. Just commit for 6 months. And I will also take the thinking out of it. I will do a curated subscription of seasonal flavors. I'm really excited because my goal is to reach 1,000 subscriptions. That's $45,000 a month of revenue that I can rely on as opposed to applying for loans, just relying on these outside sources for revenue. And it's very stressful, or having to face the decision of, do I lay off my entire staff? So that's basically the idea is, how do I make it so that it's a little more predictable and it's not all impulse buy generated revenue? It's not something I would have ever thought of before.
That was Uli Nasibova, owner of Gelateria Uli here in Los Angeles. Let us know, would you, what's going on in your own personal economy? Ice cream or not? Gelato, I suppose, or not. You can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, following up on the item a couple of days ago about the Trump administration's new rules on foreign students, that if the schools in which those students are enrolled went all online, those students would have to leave the country or find another school that would let them study in person. Anyway, the news today is that Harvard and MIT are suing to block that rule, more, as they say, to come. Okay, we're going. Here is your moment of economic context on this, where are we, Wednesday? Yes, Wednesday. Precious metals division is what this one is. Gold closed today at a nine-year high, $1,800 an ounce. It's among the safest of safe havens, as I'm sure you know, a place investors go when things are looking bleak. Also, though, it's often a hedge against volatility, the vagaries, say, of a pandemic economy, right? Our media production team, the ones going into the studios so the rest of us don't have to, include Robin Edgar, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Talladay, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.